Welcome to the Friday Night Clive podcast with me, Clive Payne. In this podcast, we look back at the amazing charities, organisations and people we have chatted to over the past few months, all of whom have interesting and important stories to tell. Now, the black and white striped badger is an iconic species in the UK and our biggest land predator. It's a common species, turning up in gardens as well as inhabiting woodland, farmland and grassland. Around the UK, licences are issued as part of the government's 25-year bovine tuberculosis eradication strategy to cull badgers. Not everybody accepts either the need for this or for the methods employed, including the Badger Trust. Between 2013 and 2019, nearly 68,000 badgers have been killed as part of the government strategy. Dominic Dyer is the Chief Executive Officer of the Badger Trust and joins me on the line to talk about this more. Hello, Dominic.
Hello there.
Thank you very much for joining me. What is tuberculosis in badgers, first of all? Let's get some context behind this.
Well, TB is a disease of cattle primarily. It's a disease because of the intensive cattle industry. And like humans, TB can spread in damp conditions. It can spread as cattle basically splutter and cough over each other in confined conditions for extended periods of time. And it's a disease that we've had in the cattle industry going back an awful long way. The problem is that it can spread out into wildlife. So badgers can catch the disease from cattle. Deer can catch the disease. Rats. Domestic dogs and cats. So badgers, yes, get TB from cattle, but there are questions as to how easy it is for the disease to spread back the other way. But farmers believe the only way then to reduce the disease is primarily to kill the badgers as a consequence.
So are we blaming badgers then for the TB in cattle?
Yes, we are, far too much. I wouldn't say there's never a case of a badger spreading TB back to a cow. But I think it's quite difficult in most normal circumstances in the farmed environment for that to happen. For example, you know, badgers are quite shy nocturnal animals. They largely avoid cattle in the pasture areas or in areas in farmyards, for example. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt that, you know, TB bacteria can survive in feces and urine, and it might well be that some cattle can pick up the disease as munching grass where, you know, feces from badgers' latrines have been left behind. But I don't think that's a common occurrence. Most of the detail that we have on the spread of the cattle disease shows that it's primarily cattle to cattle. The problem is the badger has been demonized as part of this bovine TB debate, very much a knee-jerk reaction for National Farmers Union and from certain livestock vets. The government have pursued the policy for short-term political economic research so far. 2013, over 68,000 badgers have died. Actually, we're waiting on the government figures for 2019. We feel there's probably another 45,000 badgers killed last year. So that will take the figure way up to nearly 110,000. So
what evidence is there that it's transmitted between from cattle to cattle? What research has been done to prove that?
Well, DEFRA have done an awful lot of research on that issue. And, you know, you can see in the figures that they will provide, and you can look yourself that, you know, the amplification of the disease through the cattle herd is the primary problem. So once it gets into a cattle herd, if animals are kept in confined spaces or moved around the country in large numbers, if the TB testing systems, which currently the farmers have, which is primarily a skin test that was developed in the 1930s, is not the most accurate test. So when a farm vet goes on and basically undertakes this test for the farmer, Often, maybe in one in three cases, a cow will show up as not having the disease when actually it still has it and it's pumping it out into the rest of the herd. Mm-hmm. So it's not all the farmer's fault. The testing systems are not always accurate. The movement of cattle can spread the disease through cattle markets. And as we move millions of cattle across the country every year, silage and things like that on the farm, the use of slurry can actually have bacteria from TB in it that can spread it as well. And poor biosecurity generally on the farm all can contribute to the spread of the disease. So in many ways, these are the key problems that need to be addressed rather than just killing badgers.
What are the effects of TB in both badgers and cattle then? If I was a livestock owner, say, for example, how would I know?
Well, you know, often you won't know, as far as the farmer is concerned, that the cow has TB until it actually goes to the slaughterhouse. And when it's opened up, you can see the TB lesion. So it's not that the actual cow within its relatively short life, bearing in mind most cattle for beef will only live for about 30 months or so before slaughter. Obviously, dairy cows can live longer, but they have a relatively short productive life. show symptoms during that period of time. So it's only via the test that the farmer knows that the disease is there, and then that there's a slaughter process that results. The reason the cattle is slaughtered is because it's a zoonotic disease. So obviously we're looking at, you know, the coronavirus at the moment from China. That's a zoonotic disease that's spread from animals. Well, TB is another disease that's spread from animals into people, which is why it's a notifiable disease. And before we started to pasteurize milk, for example, in the 1920s and 30s, lots of people got TB as a result of drinking unpasteurized milk or having meat from slaughterhouses where they hadn't removed TB legions and the hygiene controls were not as good as they are today. So there's still a concern it can come back, and that's the reason why if a TB infected cow is found, it has to be slaughtered.
In your opinion, does the evidence and science support the cull of badgers?
Not to the degree that we've been doing. I think this has been an indiscriminate, very cruel policy. We're basically killing large numbers of animals, most of which don't have TB at all. So on average, probably 80-85% of all the badgers killed so far don't have the disease. And you could keep killing them and it's going to make no difference. So none of the animals are being tested. They're just being killed indiscriminately across broader areas of the country, over 41 zones at the moment, from Cornwall in the southwest all the way up to Cumbria. So we see it's an indiscriminate policy. It's cost nearly £60-70 million of public money so far. It's also very cruel because we're using primarily a controlled shooting system where farmers basically, or shooters, entice badgers or fowler badger sets by baiting, you know, with peanuts and things outside the set, and then try and shoot them quickly with a rifle. They're a difficult animal to kill straight out because they're squat, muscular, very shy. You're doing this at night, so often the animals are wounded. And the government's own research has shown that it can take up to 5 minutes or more for animals to die of multiple bullet wounds and blood loss and organ failure. So that's cruel, it's expensive, and it's indiscriminate. And we believe that killing large numbers of these animals is not making a great deal of difference to lowering the disease in cattle.
We spoke to the National Farmers Union and they told us that the research into the effectiveness of the badger cull in the original cull zones, and this is in Gloucestershire and Somerset, showed a 66% reduction in new TB breakdowns in cattle in Gloucestershire and a 37% reduction in Somerset. What's your view on that?
Well, those figures, you know, to be quite frank, have more holes than a Swiss cheese. You know, I went to a presentation by Professor Crystal Donnelly at Oxford University a few weeks ago, and she's one of the key people in this area that's worked on it for many years. And the problem is that we're not certain, because if you're looking at where you're culling badgers, you're also taking measures to tighten up the controls on TB testing, on biosecurity and movement controls. So unless you can take out all the other factors that's going on in that area from the badger culling, you can never be certain what the impact of culling is. So these figures are basically based on scientific modelling. And even the academics themselves that are doing this work, primarily funded by the government, do put caveats into their published data to say that we cannot read too much into this to show that this is definitely showing that killing large numbers of badgers is lowering the disease. And in Gloucestershire, actually, if we looked at 2019, we've seen over 130% spike in the number of new TB incidents in herds. And that trend has continued into this year, looking at the latest data. So we've been culling badgers for over 6 years in that county. And actually, the trend in terms of new cases is going the opposite way. In other counties, it's beginning to lower. But again, you can't be certain if that's down to badger culling or other factors. So, you know, the government of the Labour Party was in office under Gordon Brown back in the mid-noughties, 2007 onwards, undertook what was called a randomized badger culling trial, where they killed over 50,000 badgers, 11,000 badgers, and spent £50 million in the process to actually get results which showed that culling those animals didn't make a significant contribution to lowering bovine TB in cattle. And actually, the better way of dealing with it was by tightening up the testing, the movement controls, and biosecurity within the cattle industry. So I know the NFU will continue to defend, they will continue to use that data, but I don't think it's enough in itself to prove that the destruction of these wild animals in the numbers that we're doing at the moment.
So should we forget about culling badgers then and focus on cattle?
I think we need to do two things. We can vaccinate badgers against bovine TB using the BCG vaccine that we use in humans. And if we get animals that don't have the disease, and this is backed up by the government's own data, and they are funding some of these vaccination projects, we can lower the rate of TB spread in disease-free badgers by over 70%. And that actually feeds through to newborn cubs. So badger vaccination is worth doing. And at the end of the day, trapping a badger is relatively simple. They will sit in the cage overnight. You can vaccinate it and release it in the morning, and we're getting much better at that. So badger vaccination is a viable alternative rather than culling to lower the animals, the disease in the animals. And also, we know we're getting to those animals because we're targeting rather than indiscriminate culling. cheaper because you don't have to apply all the policing costs that cost tens of millions of pounds. It's much more popular with the public. The other thing that we do need to move forward is vaccination of cattle. And this has been a difficult issue, but it is beginning to open up because of leaving the European Union. If we do stop live animal exports, as Boris Johnson has suggested he wants to, it opens up the door to us to develop a cattle vaccination trial here in Britain, working, for example, with one of the major retailers like Sainsbury's or Waitrose or another retailer within their supply chain. Again, using a vaccine for cattle, using a vaccine for badgers, tightening up on the TB testing systems, and that technology is getting better. There's new systems coming through, and tightening down on the movement and biosecurity controls. All of those things could actually make a significant contribution to lowering bovine TB without having to wipe out wildlife.
Who should fund that? Because if I was a livestock owner or a farmer and I can't afford to vaccinate my cattle, who's going to pay for that?
Well, at the moment, we do pay for it because, the government, through the taxpayer system, basically compensates farmers for animals that are slaughtered for TB. So me and you are paying for that.
Yeah.
And we're paying that for tens of millions of pounds. The vaccination of badgers is cheaper than the culling of badgers.
Yeah.
At the moment, if you trap a badger and shoot it with a shotgun, which is what a lot of these animals are being killed under the coal licenses, you have to police the zones. Each of those zones is costing nearly over £500,000 alone. If you're vaccinating, no one's out there trying to stop that process. Actually, you've got lots of volunteers who give their time free of charge. the National Farmers Union is taking a judicial review against the government for stopping the culling of badgers in Derbyshire, where we do have effective badger vaccination projects. And they've even dragged the partner of the Prime Minister, Carrie Simmons, into that debate because of meetings I had with her in Downing Street. But the point we're making is that the government were right to stop culling in Derbyshire because we've proven that we can actually work with farmers, landowners in that county and develop effective vaccination projects. And we want to see those rolled out in other parts of the country as well.
Sure. I mean, we approached the NFU and we invited them onto the programme. They were unable to join us, but instead issued a statement. And they've said that bovine TB remains one of the biggest threats to our beef and dairy industry in large parts of the country, including the West Midlands. And it's crucial that the government pursues all controls it can to eradicate it. The NFU has always supported an approach to tackling this devastating disease, which includes strengthening cattle movements, vaccination measures where appropriate, biosecurity and controlling the disease in wildlife. The chief vet has said that taking action to prevent the reservoir of disease in local badger populations is an essential part of the government's TB eradication strategy. He goes on to say that it's been proven without doubt that badgers are a reservoir of BTB and that disease transmits between badgers and cattle and vice versa. Finally, they concluded by saying controlling the disease in wildlife, therefore, in areas where it's rife is an absolutely vital part of any package of measures if we are to successfully get on top of this disease and stop reinfection occurring. That's a statement from the NFU.
Well, it's an interesting one, and they have been saying that for many years. The one thing I would say that's interesting in this debate is the changing nature of the farming industry.
Mm-hmm.
Professor Ian Boyd, who was a former DEFRA chief scientist who oversaw this policy when it was originally initiated in 2013, stepped down from his position and retired from DEFRA last year. But now he's been very openly talking and writing articles in the media, and he'll be speaking at the Badger Trust Symposium this year in November to say that actually the problem is primarily with the cattle industry. We have too much livestock production in Britain. We need to lower it for two reasons. One, because it's a significant contributor to climate change and we've got to deal with that. Second, if we move more to plant-based diets and reduce meat and dairy consumption, we'll improve of our overall health as well as reducing those emissions. And if we reduce the level of livestock farming, we can rewild parts of the country, which will restore natural habitats and lower the disease problems associated with bovine TB and other diseases that in turn have a negative impact on the environment and wildlife as well. So, the point I'm making, and I continue to make this when I debate with the NFU, is that we can't continue just to have the same farming systems churning out the same pollution problems, causing the growing problems about climate change and not addressing what we're seeing as a rapid change in the way that people are consuming food. Since 1974, the consumption of milk has declined by 50%. And now what we're seeing is a significant decline in meat and dairy as people look for alternatives. So I'm not saying farmers should go out of business, but what I am saying is that they need to react positively to what changes are happening and to also look at what's going on in the environment and what they need to do. The problem with the badger cull issue, in my view, it's like a canary in the coal mine. It's indicative of what are relatively outdated, outmoded farming systems that are causing pollution. And TB is just another form of pollution from cattle going into wildlife. And as a consequence, if all we're doing is then destroying the wildlife, We can create wildlife-free zones around all our farms, but that would be three-quarters of the landscapes of this country. And the problem we have with badger culling is by the end of this year, probably 110,000 badgers will have been killed since 2013. We are taking a case to the Berne Convention, which is the international treaty the government has signed up to for the protection of badgers, because we have the largest population of badgers anywhere in Northern Europe and Britain. But if we continue to kill them at the rate we are, we're pushing them to the verge of extinction in areas of the country where they've lived since the Ice Age, and they might not come back. And we're saying that is a serious ecological issue that we have to address. And it's no good the NFU just keeps saying we've got to keep killing them on that basis.
Why do you think people make such a fuss about it? And why do you think it's such an emotive subject?
Badgers are incredible. You know, I've written a book about badgers. You know, today I woke up to an article in The Guardian that's in America that's now flying around the world about Donald Trump's obsession with badgers. I don't know if you've read it. I should have sent it to you. But by all accounts, Donald Trump has an obsession about badgers to such a degree that when he has national security briefings and meetings, he just stops the discussion and asks his colleagues about, have you got any pictures of badgers, and asks about their behavior and ecology and things. So, you know, these stories come up all the time. I can't explain why. You know, everyone gets dragged into badgers. You know, the partner of the Prime Minister has got dragged into badgers, which is all going to play out in the High Court on the 1st of April, which is going to basically bring into the debate in court for the first time a living sitting Prime Minister's partner's influence over a policy decision. So that's going to be quite a monumental court case, which again is centered around discussions I had in Downing Street about badgers. Badgers pop up everywhere. I think you saw the story a few days ago about the badger coming through the roof of Safeway in Northampton.
Oh, crumbs.
Which has made headlines all over the country. It was on the roof and it fell through.
Oh, dear.
And actually was rescued by the local badger group and was very healthy. But those sorts of stories emerge all the time. We have a love-hate relationship with them. They dominate our discussion. If you just Google, you'll see there's more discussion and debate about badgers than anything else. Some of it's political because of bovine TB. Some of it's, you know, relating to culture and history. But they are fascinating animals. So, yeah, I can't explain.
They are. I have been close up to them, actually. A couple of years ago when on holiday I went on a night hike, and they took us to very near a badger's set, and they'd previously put some food out. Clearly it was pitch dark, but there was a red light on, which I think it enabled us to see them, but I don't think it affected the badgers. And as long as we were quiet, they came out to feast. And the way, just to stand and watch them for half an hour, absolutely fascinated me.
They are incredible animals. And, you know, I've worked in this business for a number of years in terms of conservation, but before that I worked in farming and agriculture as well, and I know a lot about farming and food production around the world. So I'm not oblivious to the issues we've been discussing about the difficulties of livestock farmers, and I do have sympathies for them. I think the problem with the badger is it's got caught up in other debates, and it often gets blamed for things, that it's not really fair.
So it's a lack of education then?
Yeah, and we do, you know, there's a lot of persecution of these animals as well. Let's put the badger cull aside. You know, you have people who still put dogs down badger sets and rip them apart for baiting, which is horrific and illegal. We have a lot of problems with building developers filling in badger sets because they get in the way of what they want to do. You know, the HS2 debate is interesting. You know, obviously it's now going ahead and it's still controversial, particularly for the environment. But the HS2 ecology team have been very good. They put over £13 million into producing, you know, plans to relocate badgers along the rail route, and we've been working with them on that basis. So, you know, there's good practice out there. There are people that do the right thing to protect these animals. The trouble with badgers is they're not like sort of newts. They can't be easily moved. They dig. They make a lot of mess. They can dig under roads. They can dig under rugby pitches and football pitches. And if we sort of move into their areas where they're living, they tend to have to go somewhere else, and that can cause problems. But they're amazing, resilient animals. They're beautiful to watch and to look at. And it's good to see Donald Trump is fascinated by badgers. I don't know if you saw the video of the American badger and the coyote going through the tunnel, which again went viral about 10 days ago. Which is, again, if you just Google it, you'll see why. It's a bit like a Disney film where the coyote welcomes the badger and then they sort of waddle off down this tunnel together. It was taken by an American research project on a camp, sort of a wild sort of camp thing there. But it was amazing footage, and it's just caught the imagination of the world. And I think we are fascinated by these animals, actually, and their behavior and what they do. And that's a good thing. And, you know, I go to a lot of schools and colleges and talk about British wildlife and the fact that we only see these animals often dead by the side of the road. So if you get a chance to see them, you know, up front, living in the wild conditions, it is a wonderful experience.
It certainly was for me, I have to say. Going back to the culls, though, where exactly are these culls taking place? Because you say they're still happening. It's still ongoing.
Yes, There are about 41 zones at the moment. You know, they've been started initially in 2013 in Gloucestershire and Somerset and Cornwall and Devon and Dorset, but they've moved up the country to Cheshire, to Cumbria, to Warwickshire and other areas now as well. So, and we expect that to be, you know, expanded even further if the government and the NFU get their way this year. You know, the danger is that we'll be culling badgers across significant parts of the country in such a systematic way, effectively, that we'll be pushing them down, as I said earlier, to points where they just can't return in populations.
Who is actually culling the badgers, though, Dominic? Who's actually doing it?
It's the contractors employed by the National Farmers Union and the government cull licences. So basically, they have one day's training. People will go out and shoot these animals with shotguns or with rifles. They cage trap them or they will control shoot them, as I said earlier. We have concerns about much of the training and lack of monitoring and the humaneness issues around it. And, you know, when you're killing wild animals at this scale, there's going to be a lot of, you know, problems relating to that. And there's not much in the way of effective monitoring of what's going on.
And they get paid for doing this, so, I guess.
Yeah, they're not paid money. I think they get paid an average £30-40 a badger, you know, as the contract.
And how do they dispose of the badgers afterwards? Because if
they're bagged up and they are incinerated, they're counted, bagged up and incinerated.
Right.
We released some pictures last year from an incineration plant where we got some photos of bagged badgers that the Daily Mirror and others published, which weren't very pleasant, but it got across what they were trying to get across.
So it's largely
done away from public eyes, so people don't see this. It's been carried out largely in secret in isolated areas.
But it's reasonable to suggest that if that badger is bagged up and if it's carrying TB, there's a risk of cross-contamination from that badger's journey from wherever it was culled to the point of incineration, isn't it?
There is, and we've seen bad practice where they're not bagged up properly and thrown on the back of lorries and things. So, you know, you have this problem. There are rules where they're meant to be double bagged and make sure that you don't have a danger of contamination, but you're relying on poorly paid contractors in remote rural locations to follow the rules, and in some cases they're not doing that. So it's a genuine concern we have about that spread of disease in those areas as well.
And can that disease spread through the fumes that are generated from the incineration plant?
No, it can't. It can spread through blood and it can, you know, feces and other material of that kind. We've also had a concern about foxhounds as well, because we found the Kimberwick hunt 2 years ago. It's a well-known hunt in southern England where basically, fallen cows are taken from the fields. The cows get struck by lightning and die for different reasons, and there are slaughtermen that take them away. They don't get inspected for TB before they're fed raw meat to the hounds. The foxhounds eat it. Now, in this instance, the foxhounds ate a TB-infected carcass. The hounds then became infected with TB, and then a significant number of the hounds had to be put down as a consequence. But, you know, prior to that, they were going around fields and defecating and urinating as they do, spreading the disease left, right, and centre. So, you know, that's another example of where there's just not been sufficient controls where we believe the disease can be spread. Also, cattle markets, you know. And remember, the disease really came about, it spread rapidly in 2001. Prior to that, there was about 4,800 cases in the national herd every year, so it was a relatively small problem. It was foot and mouth that caused the massive expansion. So when we had the foot and mouth outbreak, the biggest since 1968, in 2001, the government initiated a massive cull of sheep and cattle. Millions of animals were killed. They shut the countryside down effectively for 6 months, delayed an election, spent about £8 billion on compensation for farmers and rural businesses. It was a huge economic challenge. But then the National Farmers Union decided it needed to restock cattle quickly to get farmers back going, and it took most of the cattle up from the southwest. And the chief veterinary officer at the time told Tony Blair, as prime minister, that you need to put in place stiff TB checks before you move the cattle. But the NFU said, well, listen, we need those cattle moved on farm much more quickly because otherwise farmers are not going to get back in business. So they basically lifted the controls for over 18 months. And what we found is we had a massive spike in bovine TB. We moved it up the country. So by 2002, it had gone from, you know, basically to nearly from 4,800 to about 28,000 cattle a year. And it's never really come down below that.
That's an extraordinary amount.
It is an extraordinary amount, but when you think about the consequences of what we were doing, you were moving large numbers of animals with no controls, you know, across the country. You were going to spread the disease like wildfire, and that's what we did. But it was a, you know, a poor decision by government under pressure from the farming industry that has led us to where we are now. And as a consequence, we're killing a lot of badgers. So when people say to me, who's to blame for bovine TB, I say, actually, the government of Tony Blair's government and the NFU at the time, who basically allowed all those controls to be put to one side to restock after foot and mouth.
Other than the Badger Trust, then, what other organisations are working to stop the culling of badgers?
The Wildlife Trust are doing a lot of good work. You know, Derbyshire is an example. The National Trust are vaccinating badgers, doing a lot of good work. Mm-hmm. Organisations like the RSPCA, you know, organisations like the Zoological Society of London are doing various research work on vaccination of badgers as well. So, you know, a lot of the conservation organisations are committed to trying to find solutions.
Sure.
A lot of farmers don't want to cull. You know, we're working with many that want to vaccinate badgers. A lot of vets don't want to see culling. And we're increasingly getting more vets who are supporting, you know, the call. And as I said earlier on, even the former chief scientist at DEFRA has come to the conclusion that actually the farming systems themselves are largely to blame for this and other problems, and we have to change those as well.
It strikes me as if the whole thing needs a complete overhaul.
Absolutely. You know, and you can't sit where I am now and look at the whole system of farming and food production and think that it's actually delivering what we need. You know, at the end of the day, you know, we're a country that is facing significant climatic change here and around the world. We do not need to consume, or we can't afford to consume continually the amount of meat and dairy that we are. You know, if I was a dairy farmer today, and I look out from where I'm living across the way and I can see some dairy farms and they're struggling to survive, you know, I would get out of dairy and I'd produce oat milk. You know, oat milk is selling like hotcakes. It's premium. Yeah. It's clean. You can grow the oats and turn them into a milk product and sell it into the supermarkets at a premium price without any of the disease and control issues around farming. Livestock. And I think that's where a lot of this is going to head. You know, a new generation of farmers are not going to get off the land. Why should they? What they want to do is to innovate and develop crops that will give them premiums without some of the problems associated with what is, to be quite frankly, a tired, dirty industry, which is becoming increasingly difficult to make a good living in. So I don't want to see all farmers go out of business. I don't want to see all livestock farmers go out of business. But I do think we need to be willing to change. And I think that's something the farming industry has to face up to. Many farmers are, but I'm afraid the National Farmers Union haven't quite got there yet.
I think the debate will go on for some significant years yet, I think. But it's
we'll be talking badgers. I think we could come back in 10 years and we'll still be debating this one. I just hope.
Let's make a date.
Yes, I know. Because, you know, I've already been looking at it from 7 years on, from 2000. So we're a long way into it. I just hope we can get to a point where we don't keep killing wildlife to produce food. That's the broader issue I'll leave your listeners with, because I don't think that's a good thing to do in any stretch. We need to treasure our landscapes and our wildlife, and also to support our farmers. But we need to do better for both, really, in that sense.
Dominic Dyer, Chief Executive Officer of the Badger Trust. Thank you very much for talking to Friday Night Clive.
Not at all. You're welcome.
You are listening to the Friday Night Clive podcast. If you like what you are hearing, don't forget to subscribe to get the latest installment at blackcountryradio.co.uk/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. Now, on with this week's episode. Now, if someone's heart stopped beating, would you know what to do? Well, we'll cover this topic of first aid at some point in the future here on Friday Night Clive, but I'm talking about what we know as sudden adult death syndrome. We hear about it more nowadays, particularly in the news as a result of the loss in recent times of notable sports people, but it can sadly happen to anyone. Imagine that it happens to not one, not two, but three of your children. Well, that's exactly what happened to Rob and Maggie Underwood from Worcestershire back in 2010 when they lost their daughter, Charlotte, at the age of 16. They went on to lose two further children in the following years in the same circumstances. But if they had easy access to defibrillators, things may well have been different. I spoke with Rob recently and he told me their story, and I began by asking him about the circumstances surrounding the loss of Charlotte.
Well, it actually started on the 19th of December 2010. On the Sunday morning, Charlotte woke up with a swollen face. Mm-hmm. We took her to primary care. The doctor looked at her, said, "You've got mumps. There's a prescription for some ibuprofen. Basically, go home."
Mm-hmm.
Approximately 6-7 hours later, Charlotte was screaming. We had to call 999. Sadly, she stopped breathing, and the operator gave us instructions how to perform CPR until paramedics arrived.
Yeah.
And then we were conveyed off to hospital, where, to be fair to the hospital staff there, we can't take nothing away from them. They worked tirelessly with Charlotte, tried every possibility that they could to bring her back. And after quite a few hours, we were called into the resuscitation room, and we had the daunting task to basically tell them to stop, which is the worst thing you can ever do to anybody, ask them to stop. It's trying to save your child.
But that's a really difficult decision to make, isn't it?
It is, and being through that, you do understand how hospital staff do it, because they do it day in, day out. Mm-hmm. It's still daunting and hard for them. And as a parent, who don't have to deal with that type of thing every day, you don't want to send them word stop.
What went through your mind, and really, what were your emotions like when you heard the words life extinct? That's a technical term they use in hospital.
Yes. I think they do need to look at the cells sometimes. Not the cells, but the way it is actually called when parents are there.
But it's quite a clinical expression, isn't it? It's a technical expression.
We know they have to go through their protocol. Yes. We know that. But to stand in front of parents and go, life extinct, or died at so-and-so time, except, I think they might need to look at changing the choice of words, because even hearing that can be more daunting sometimes than actually the event actually happening.
Well, extinct is actually a strong word.
It is, yes. Really? We understand it's medical. They've got to do it.
Yeah.
It's formality. But yeah, I think...
What was the impact that losing Charlotte had on your family? Because obviously you had to go home from the hospital.
Oh, yeah. That was hard to go home to, having to tell her siblings. Sorry, your sister's not coming home.
Yeah. And how did they respond? Did they understand?
Devastated. Completely and utterly devastated. Because nobody knew nothing. This was unexpected.
No, that's right.
Because the day before, she was due to go in hospital to have Erica's veins removed in her legs.
Right.
And obviously, from what we found out, from what we know now, it was a high possibility that the veins, the arteries, actually burst. And from when she was at home, we performed CPR on her. She was actually internally bleeding to death. And we didn't know that.
No.
Unfortunately, and maybe something else could have been done. No, we don't know. It's all hindsight now. What if can be done?
Yeah.
You can't live your life wondering what if, where, when. Unfortunately, it's happened, and you can't do nothing about it. You can't change the outcome.
Now, in a cruel twist of fate, in 2013, you lost Craig, one of your other children, in exactly the same circumstances. Now, how did you deal with losing a second child? And in fact, you went to lose three of your children, sadly.
Yes, but we did, yes.
In exactly the same way. So what was that like? Because that's just cruel.
Yes, once you lose a child, you'll never get over it. But you learn to deal with it, and 3 years down the line, pretty much to the day, when Carrick was in the field, he called 999 himself and said, something's happening to me. You need to find me, because I'm about to join my sister.
That was what he said?
Yeah, that's what he said to the 999 caller.
Then what happened?
His friend found him slumped in the field, tried to perform CPR. Devastated him, because it didn't work. But unbeknown to his friend, no amount of CPR would have saved him, because his aorta actually tore full from top to bottom. And with it like that, there's nothing you can actually do. But losing Craig, it I don't want to say it was worse than Charlotte, but as time goes on, you learn more and more about your children when they're young. So we had another 3 years with Craig, so we knew a lot more about him. He'd gone into pretty much the adulthood. Even though he was 17, he'd grown up quite well. For us as a family, to do it was incomprehensible. We didn't know what we were going to do. We didn't know where we were going to turn. We didn't know who to talk to. We didn't know what to do. Two children.
Where did you seek help from? Who supported you?
To believe it or not, we know now. At the time, we didn't really know as much, but with losing Craig and then follow on with Carrick, the community of Redditch, the people that got in touch and spoke to us, offered us support, so I didn't go and talk to them, unbiased opinions and things like that. It helped. It really did. We can't thank the people, and the people are still there to this day supporting us, and we can't thank them enough for doing that. excuse me, but with losing Craig, we were quitting. Because we thought to ourselves, well, we can't even save our own children. What are we going to do? We can't save other people. If we can't do ours, we can't help anybody else. You do get in these turmoil situations, and actually on the day we were quitting, I did have a phone call from a supermarket where we'd donated a defibrillator to. A gentleman had collapsed in front of my wife, in front of Maggie. He performed CPR on him, etc. Saved his life. Came home, sat there for a few weeks, spoke about it, and we decided that we would continue, because after you do a lot of research, we found at the time there was between 12 and 15 young adults, children, dying in and around our schools in the UK. It's higher than that now. That's 12 to 15 families every week going through heartache, turmoil, not knowing what to do, where to go. They've lost a child.
Yeah.
And if we can prevent that, the same as any other charity up and down the country that deals with cardiac arrest and defibrillators, because there's a lot of us out there.
So how did you learn, though, that it was what I would describe as sudden adult death syndrome?
It was when we lost Charlotte, because it was put down to cardiac arrest, and because of her age, it's put down to the umbrella SADS, sudden arrhythmic death syndrome. And as parents, you tend to want to know what that is, because you've lost your child and you try to find out information. It was really scary at the time going through it all, because one link leads you to another and you think, well, is that one right or is that one right? You don't know. But we found out stats and figures, approximately 15 children a week at the time back in 2010, as well as how many other adults, around 80, 100,000 a year. That's a lot of people. So you do, as a family, we wanted to do something, bearing in mind we were only going to do one defibrillator in memory of Charlotte. Craig helped us fundraise. He was an avid supporter. He was always with us. We continued for him.
Yeah.
Because he kept doing it in memory of his sister. And we only had the unfortunate task of doing it in memory of both of them. It's hard every single day of the week.
Sure.
But when you do raise enough money to buy a defibrillator and you've donated it into a school or into a cabinet, into the community, so it's available 24 hours a day, it makes you feel something out of it, because you know it's potentially there to help somebody. Even though we can't personally do it, there is a piece of equipment and can potentially help your loved one. Get it and use it.
Yes.
You know, don't be scared of it.
Sure.
They are scary things, because everybody always thinks only hospitals, doctors, paramedics, etc. can use them. Anybody can use them, from no matter what, as long as you can understand what it's doing, no matter what your age, you can use them.
What screening has been undertaken to check your other children?
Oh, when we lost Craig, it was down to genetics. They'd done some tests. We were looking at other conditions apart from the SADS. We were hoping and praying it was going to be Lewis Dietz, Marvan, or something similar like that, because we know that's not life-limiting, because we'd researched quite a few of these conditions. But unfortunately, it came back where they've got a condition called vascular Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. Now, a lot of people know of EDS, the Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, because there's quite a few.
Now, I've never heard of that.
You've got hypermobility, where your bones and your joints can just pop out and things like that. There's lots of different criteria to the EDS part, but we've actually got the vascular side, which we'd have been happy with EDS. But we're having the vascular, that's where things change. And now this is where it makes it life-limiting. No medication, no surgery. Unfortunately, if one of their arteries starts to bleed out, any organ, any hollow organ, anything like that starts to bleed out, they're basically going to die because they can't open them up. Well, they can open them up, obviously, but they can't perform any surgery, because it will be like forgot to stitch up like a wet paper bag, because part of it is we're lacking in our own body's glue, collagen. People say, "Oh, drink plenty of gin, it's got collagen in it." Different type of collagen. Yeah. So please, people, think twice when you're thinking. It's not going to help you.
do not hit the alcohol bottle.
No, anything that says it's got collagen in it, it's not to help your body. It's just something that... But, yeah, and that was brought up through Craig's tests, and then we had to wait. And then we had the daunting task of having the other children tested.
Mm-hmm.
The older siblings all went and had their tests. It came back that they've all got it.
Gosh.
Apart, well, we're not 100% sure yet. Our two younger ones, Mitchell and Poppy, we're still awaiting for them to be tested, because it is quite expensive.
So it's not the kind of test that can be just done in say, a local hospital?
Because they now know what they're looking for, the gene, everything else. They know what they look. They can pinpoint it when they're done. So it won't take as long as the original test, because they didn't know what they were looking for.
Mm.
They had to wait for it to mutate on the slides, and it came up. So, I don't know. This condition, something does need. There is a leading charity for this, and they're based in this country. It's Annabelle's Challenge, based in Bury up in Manchester.
Yes.
They have been godsend to us. They've pinpointed and sent us into the right directions. They know everything about this condition. I think the charity was set up because their daughter Annabelle was the youngest child to be diagnosed with vascular EDS. So they've started this, and they're working really close with the NHS and the genetics and things like that to possibly find something. So they've been our godsend. They're our backbone. They help and support us whenever we need it.
So how do you go about fundraising to enable you to place these defibrillators at key locations? And how do you also decide where they should go?
We pretty much do anything to fundraise.
Right.
How crazy it is, how simple it is, I don't care. Mm. If it can raise some money and it can save a life, why not?
Mm-hmm.
All it is
and have
my
some
time.
Fun with doing it as well.
Exactly. All it is time that you're giving. Yes, sometimes time is precious. I know that. Hand on my heart, I know how precious time is. But when you're doing things like this, yes, and it can bring the community together, depending on what you're doing and what the cause is and the activity. But we've done crazy things.
Mm.
We hold annual fund days to try and raise money. People kindly have done things for us. We've now got, I think it's 18 or 19 people running the Vitality Half Marathon in London, start of March, to raise money for the charity to help buy defibs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the support we get from other people. As a charity, we don't have a wage come out of this. We don't believe in it. It's charitable money.
Mm-hmm.
It's people who go out there, work hard to donate us a pound. They've worked hard to get that pound, and they're donating it to us. Why should we sort of make 10 or 20 pence out of the pound go towards the cause, and the rest is overhead and wages? I guess it's because we've set up for personal reasons.
Sure.
And we understand it. We're not there to try and treat it as a business. Mm. So we'll do anything that we possibly can to fundraise. Yeah. I have done, and I always will do, and I'll continue to do it.
So where do you decide where these defibrillators should go?
We always see a remit where high footfall areas. Now, yes, high footfall, obviously thousands, could be thousands of people walking around at any given time, but it only takes one person to drop in cardiac arrest. You could be outside somewhere, hardly anybody around. Doesn't necessarily mean because it's high footfall. It can happen anywhere, any given time. So there is no really protocol to say, oh, they have to go here, they have to go there, etc. If somebody wants one and put it on the front of their house, which I'm about in the process of doing, why not? You know, if we could put one, we'll say, for example, on every street where everybody lives or in the area, and you've got the community involved. Now, sometimes on estates you've got 300 or 400 houses, sometimes even more. Now, when you look at the cost of the defibrillator, if each family, I know times are hard, but if each family put £1 or £2 or whatever in, there's your defibrillator for your community. It's that simple and that easy.
That's right.
Just by donating a simple little thing. And you have it on your own street. It gets registered with the ambulance service. So it makes sure that it's available 24/7.
Mm.
So anybody can use it. You don't have to put it outside. But I tend to say to people, you know, if you've got a defibrillator, one, register with the ambulance service, let them know. Because simply, you know the importance of having one, otherwise you would not have one.
That's right.
So let's give everybody else the chance of surviving. Don't withhold it. Don't just think, oh, it's only for me. Because your next-door neighbour could need it, and you're going to sit there and go, oh, no, it's mine. It sits in my house.
Mm.
Try and think of your community and other people around you.
So for anybody who doesn't know what a defibrillator does, talk me through what they do. Now, you've actually bought a unit for me in the studio, haven't you?
Yes, I always carry a live one with me just in case the unforeseen does happen and
so we
can help.
We won't play with the live one, obviously.
Well, you can, but it won't do nothing to you because you're alive.
You're alive, that's right. Yes. But you've got a training model here, haven't
yes.
you?
Yes.
So tell me first of all what a defibrillator does.
Basically, it's a machine. You put some pads onto somebody, just like when you go into hospital and you see it on TV. Do the same thing, put the pad, listen to what the machine says to you and follow it every step of the way. You don't need no training to use one.
No.
That's the biggest myth that people need to...
That angers me because I heard that said many years ago and I know it to be absolute tosh for the simple reason that you've just alluded to. They talk to you, they tell you where to place the pads.
Yes.
So shall we get the one going that you brought with you? And so what Rob's going to do, he's just going to go to the back of the studio and he's bought a training device which we're going to put either on the chair or maybe on the desk. Or maybe on your lap, Rob, I don't know which. So if somebody, let's start from the beginning. If somebody suddenly collapses.
Yes.
You first need to check.
Yes, check that
they're breathing.
ABCs, the airway, the breathing circulation.
Okay. Well, we are going to look at first aid on Friday Night Clive at a future date, so I'm not going to touch too much on that. But you're right, you check the airway.
Yes. Just make sure they're not breathing. Give them a good shake and a shout. See if you can get a response from them. Always call 999. It's most important because if you have to get a defibrillator from a cabinet, you have to tell the ambulance service a little code that's on the cabinet. That pinpoints your location, so if you're a stranger in town, at least they know where to come.
Mm-hmm.
So once the defib has been taken out the cabinet,
mm-hmm.
you just take it to the casualty and open the case. If it's in a case, lift it up the lid mm-hmm. if need be, or push a button and the lid will open. Some you have to undo a zip in the case and it's just sitting there. Some of them automatically turn on as soon as you hit the button.
Mm.
Some you have an on-off button. Simple, turn it on. Just what you need to do.
Yes.
Yeah, and just listen. If you're lucky enough, majority of defibrillators will have an LED screen.
Yes.
So even if you are profoundly deaf, you can read the voice commands step by step, just like it is on the Cardiac Science G5
sure.
that we use, and we highly endorse it through the charity because it will actually escalate higher where a lot of them are preset to 200 joules. This will go up to over 300.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to improve the outcome of survival.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this device on your lap, it's orange and it looks roughly about the size of A4 sheet of paper. Yeah.
Yes.
So what happens when you open it up then, Rob?
As soon as you open it up, this one will turn itself automatically straight on
mm-hmm.
and then you just look inside and then you'll see just on the lid or sometimes sitting underneath is a square packet.
Follow these instructions.
Ooh.
That's good. Okay.
There is a plastic packet. The machine will tell you exactly what to do with it. Once you've done it, open it. We'll go through the step right quick. And look at the pads. Look at the mm-hmm. pictures that are on these pads.
Yeah.
And place them exactly where they need to go.
Mm-hmm.
It's not hard.
No.
If there's a number on the pad, put that pad where it says it's got to go.
Yes.
Otherwise, anywhere.
And on the pads that Rob's showing me, there's an illustration of the human torso.
Yes.
And it tells you there where on the torso these pads have to go.
Yes, exactly. Which just underneath your collarbone,
mm-hmm.
on your right-hand side.
Yeah.
And the other one just on the side, on your left-hand side, just underneath the breast.
Yes.
And just put it there. Once they're on, the machine will run an ECG
mm-hmm.
to see if you're shockable or not.
Yeah. So what will the machine do next then, Rob?
Make sure emergency services are called now.
So call emergency services, sir. As you can see
begin
on the screen.
Begin by exposing patient's bare chest.
So it is
taking... or cut clothing if needed.
You get...
So it's taking you through the steps.
When patient's chest is bare, remove the white square package from lid of AED. Tear open white package across dotted line and remove pads.
Bearing in mind, this is a training unit, a real one's...
Peel one of the white pads completely from blue plastic.
No, just simple.
Peel one off. Of the white pads completely from blue plastic.
Okay.
Begin pulling from the tabbed corner.
Just do that.
So it even tells you
firmly
how to do
place
that.
Place the pad without yes. the blue plastic on patient's bare chest, exactly as shown on pads.
Yeah, it's that's simple and easy.
This pad can be placed on either of the two locations as shown on pads.
It doesn't matter which way round, since they haven't got numbers
next,
on.
No.
Peel second white pad from the blue plastic.
So it's, yeah, okay, that's good. So it's telling you to
firmly
do that as well.
Firmly place the second pad on the other location exactly as shown on pads.
The quicker you get these pads on...
Firmly place the second pad on the other location exactly as shown on pads.
You can preempt the machine. Once they register...
Do not touch the patient. Analyzing heart rhythm.
Basically, stand clear.
Please
don't
wait.
Touch them. Let them run the ECG. Let the machine
shock
do it.
Shock advised.
So the machine...
Do not touch the patient.
So the machine then will decide whether it can detect a heart rhythm.
Yes. Yeah, if it detects that it's a shockable rhythm, then it will... Shock will be advised. Mm-hmm. Then you
press do. Red flashing button to deliver shock. Press red flash shock delivered.
And there's a big red flashing button with a heart
to touch the patient.
On the control panel that flashes at you. So you press that
yes.
and it delivers the shock and it will calculate the shock level, the amount
yes.
of joules that's required.
Because it's a semi-automatic, that's why you've got the button to push.
Mm-hmm.
You can get automatic versions where it will just tell you stand clear, preparing to shock, delivering shock, mm-hmm. shocking.
Give 30 rapid compressions and 2 breaths as instructed.
So basically, 30 compressions.
Place heel of one hand on center of chest.
It's even telling
nipples.
You how to do CPR.
Yes.
Place heel of other hand directly on top of first hand.
This is why we endorse.
Lean over patient with elbows straight.
Because of what it's got, what it tells you. The rest.
Press
of
the patient's chest down rapidly, 1/3 the depth of chest. Then release. Start CPR.
Right. So now it's telling me to start CPR. I know a lot. We all know the songs that we
yes.
can sing, Stand Alive, etc., etc. But have you tried counting and singing at the same time?
It's hard, yes, because I've had training to use these, but it's hard, and it's
it
not
is.
Something
Your
I'm
brain
very good
can
at.
Do one thing at
yes.
a time. So to sing and count, are you going to know? Unless you know where to start on the bar of the song to where it finishes for 30 compressions. It's virtually... But this,
so how does the machine help you?
How does the machine help you? Well, it's got a little monotone built into it. It tells you when to do the chest compression. It even tells you when to do the breaths. So we'll go through it.
Press, 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 press,
there
press, 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 press.
That's
press,
quite fast.
Press, press,
yes,
press,
you're doing roughly
press,
about two
press,
every second.
Press, 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 press,
there is a timer
press, press,
going
press,
up,
press,
down,
press,
2 minutes.
Press, 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 stop compressions.
That's your 30 compressions.
Yes.
Give breath.
Rescue breath.
Mm-hmm.
Give breath.
And then it'll go back into compressions again.
Continue right. with compressions.
So, and after 2 minutes, it will stop, and it will run another ECG. Every 2 minutes, it will run an ECG.
So it'll rotate that process through each time?
Every single time.
Yeah.
If casualty all of a sudden becomes start breathing, it will tell you continue CPR if needed.
Mm.
So basically, it's no shock, so obviously something is there, only if needed.
How much do these devices cost, Rob?
Depending on where you go and if somebody's willing to help you with a costs, etc. For normal stuff, they're normally around about £1,600
Right.
But through the charity, because we pass on all discounts, etc. that we get, we're under £1,000 It's £960
How many have you placed in the community? Do you know?
We're on approximately either touching or just over 400 defibrillators.
Gosh.
In the last 10 years that we've been doing this.
So how can people get involved with supporting Charlotte and Craig Saving Hearts Foundation?
I never say there's anything that anybody can actually do for us. It's whatever the individual would like to do. The sky is the limit for anybody and everybody, whether it's a menial little cup of tea day where you can raise maybe £5 or something, or whether it's an extravagant skydive or a marathon and you raise thousands of pounds. We appreciate every single... whether it's a penny or whether it's £1 million. It would be nice, £1 million, because I'd have all Redditch covered within a flash. But, you know, we do like fundraising ourselves. I've been called when I've been out fundraising. I've been in the town centre. I've had a stall up many, many years ago. And I stood there all day, freezing cold, just like it is here. And I raised £7 in 10 hours. And people called me silly. Why are you doing that? Why? And I always use round figures, not to disrespect anybody, to make it a little bit more simpler for everyone to understand. So if we use a round figure of £1,000 of a defibrillator, now in the charity's bank account, I've got £993. Now, if I went to a supermarket or a big department store and I wanted to buy something and it was £1,000, but all I had was £993, that store wouldn't let me have it.
No, that's right.
Same as a defibrillator. You can't buy it.
No.
So now who's the silly one? I've sat there, raised £7, now I can buy a defibrillator. It can go out in the community to help protect you.
And in fact,
save their life.
You've actually placed some defibrillators in the West Midlands, not just in Worcestershire, but in the West Midlands and up here in the Black Country, haven't you, as well?
Yes, as I said earlier, as pinpointed earlier, there is no specific place where we should put these. Mm. The whole country should have them. They should be law, just the same as a fire extinguisher. Because I couldn't walk into your studio or anything unless you had one fire extinguisher in this building. If there's a fire, what the fire service say? Get out. It's bricks and mortar. It can be rebuilt. Sadly, somebody on the floor, dead. They can't be rebuilt.
No.
Provision, defibrillator. The government are seeing the importance of them. They're changing things gradually. And one thing we were sort of happy with, because we've campaigned with other charities up and down the country, the government, to actually get this taught in school curriculum. And from September 2020...
That's really important.
Secondary schools, all students will be learning first aid, CPR and defibrillator use.
Good.
It's a big step in the right direction. Mm. I just wish they'd roll out to make it mandatory in all schools.
Yes.
Because even primary school children, yes, as parents we teach our children, dial 999 if mummy or daddy is ill or your brother or sister or your friend or whatever, help them. But if the primary schools can be taught simple little things as they go through, as they get older, it's not going to become scary. Because all of a sudden you go into high secondary school, boom, you're going, what on earth is that?
Mm-hmm.
Do it gradually. Start young, have fun. Build up and teach them even more in depth. Because we do now, we go into primary schools, we'll teach children, we'll have a laugh and a joke. We'll go in dressed in a mascot, one of the children's favourite characters.
Mm-hmm.
Children look at it. Oh, my character can do that. I can do it.
Sure.
And we get children to go home and practice. Because once they've gone home and practice, mum and dad are now watching them. You see, it's a big spiral effect. My two younger ones, Mitchell and Poppy, just right quick, whichever event we go to when we're at fundraising, no matter where it is, I always have a training defibrillator, I always have some resuscy hands, so anybody and everybody can have a little play. But my two younger ones, they're always the first ones there. And they're sitting there, got the defib on, they know how to use them, and the remote and everything else. And I'm standing there talking to parents sometimes, and they go, oh, I've lost my son, I've lost my daughter, where are they? And I look, what are they wearing? I say, they're over there with my two children. Oh, what are they doing over there? They're fine. I say, promise you they're fine. I say, but my two children over there doing CPR and using defib. Oh, so we explain to them a little bit more. So they're now learning. The children are learning from my two children. Whether it's simple little things. Their mum and dad are going to be going over, watching what their children have done from my two children.
Yeah.
Now parents are now learning how to do it. Simple little things. How to save a life. And that's how, as a whole, as a community, as a country, this is how we can do it.
Yes.
Because some countries, it's law. You can't even graduate from high school unless you learn this.
Yeah.
And that's why the survival rate is so high.
Sure.
And yet we're amazing country. We have some amazing ideas. But to get these ideas done, we're always the last. And I can never understand why.
No.
Yeah, but so things are changing. Things are moving forward. We are appreciative that they are changing and starting to look. But the most important thing is, and the way I'm looking at it now, yes, the children are going to be learning how to do CPR and how to use a defibrillator. But if there's no law that the defibrillators are out there, what is the point of teaching children something that the provisions are not out there for them to use?
Sure, sure.
So they need to look at it that way as well. You know, I'm teaching these children how to do this stuff, but we haven't got the provisions outside for the children to grab it to help save someone.
Yes.
They're standing there scratching their heads.
Sure.
You know, so it's all about awareness and going in and teach. Like as I said, you don't need training on these things. Awareness, the more you know, the quicker and easier it is, because believe it or not, the quicker you get the pads on somebody on a defibrillator, a shock can be administered within 10 to 12 seconds. Mm. So you can preempt the machines.
Yeah.
Get the pads on, get the machine working.
Yes.
And start, most importantly, start CPR. If you're not doing it right, fine. You're doing something rather than doing nothing until somebody else who is more competent and who does know what they're doing.
Yeah.
But do something. Because doing nothing is not an option these days. We have to do something. If it was your loved one, I guarantee you, you wouldn't stand there scratching my head and thinking, oh, I might hurt them, or I'm going to be sued. You wouldn't care. You would jump on them and you would do, get your hands on their chest and start pushing up and down.
Rob Underwood, thank you very much for telling your story and for talking to Friday Night Live.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. It's all about you.
Rob Underwood there from Craig and Charlotte's Saving Hearts Foundation, who I spoke to a couple of weeks ago. And if you want some more information about the charity, if you go to the internet and type in ccshf.org.uk, ccshf.org.uk, and there's a complete menagerie of information on their website, including ways that you can donate as well to help them place these defibrillators, not just in Worcestershire, but in the West Midlands and here in the Black Country as well. That's your lot for this episode. You can catch the show live every Friday night on Black Country Radio from 8 p.m. If you love our podcast, please subscribe by heading to blackcountryradio.co.uk/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. See you very soon. This is a Black Country Radio podcast, presented by Clive Payne, production by Andy Caddick and Alex Griffiths.